and involuntarily lowers his staff, the marauding Amalekites gain ground. Fortunately, the prophet had listened to God and allied himself with strong and reliable compatriots. When he is incapable of holding his own arms and magic wand overhead, his brother and political arm, Aaron, and a new ally, Hur, help him to maintain his encouraging and faithful stance. Hur appears as a representative of the reliable everyman, the good citizen, who upholds his responsibility in the ordinary but absolutely necessary way that the vast majority of people who do their jobs well so miraculously manage, despite the difficulties of their lives. His grandson, Bezalel, carrying on his admirable lineage, is later celebrated for his skill and divine inspiration when the tabernacle is constructed. Exodus 31, 1 to 5. Exodus 35, 30 to 35. This motif of aid to the leader is another indication of the principle of subsidiarity. Even the most capable leader cannot support the tradition and practices that protect and guide by himself. The three keep the banner waving high, so to speak, from sunrise to sundown, and the Israelites prevail. 7.6, the subsidiary state as alternative to tyranny and slavery. It is shortly after the Amalekite battle that Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, re-enters the story. Exodus 18. First, the two meet and happily reunite. Jethro, perceiving and noting all the positive progress made by the former slaves of the Egyptians and his son-in-law, their leader. Then they join together in worship, a transformation for Jethro, who was a Midianite priest. It seems that seeing all the miraculous changes wrought in the destiny of Moses and his people unites his aim with that of the family and the people he is visiting. Jethro then observes Moses in his newly acquired role as judge of the Israelites. This is something they themselves have demanded of him in principle because of his prophetic capacity. Moses' people, however, remain a disunited, self-centered, faithless, and fractious bunch, unable, and more significantly, unwilling to mediate their own disputes. That is, unwilling to take on themselves the responsibility to be self-governing. In their immaturity, they have foregone the obligation to delve deeply into the structure of morality and squandered the opportunity to learn for themselves what constitutes appropriate conduct. When two people have a dispute, each could take the occasion to divine what future option, what balance between justice and mercy, might be regarded by both parties as a satisfactory solution. A dispute emerges when the structure of meaning that one person is using to orient him or herself and to move forward conflicts with the dictates of the structure used by another. This produces a clash between two hierarchies of values or principles. From that clash can emerge a deeper uniting principle or value, but only if the conflict is faced forthrightly and then judged fairly. Existence in accordance with that emergent uniting principle is the sacrifice of narrow self-interest that makes community possible, as well as the work that integrates the present with the future when undertaken optimally. The justice of a given judgment, rendered in consequence of a conflict, can be determined by the acceptability of the solution to the parties involved. The judgment will supplant the conflict if it is regarded as just, as preferable to the complexities and troubles of the current conundrum. In consequence, peace and the possibility of cooperation will be reestablished. Poor judgment, including that imposed by force or fiat, merely ensures that the conflict will continue, even and often in a different guise. The true judge must come to deeply understand the nature of the morality that brings peace, harmony, and productivity to his people. The Israelites give up the authority to address their own troubles to Moses, who groans under the weight of the task. All that deferred responsibility is simply too much. Jethro observes this from his stance as benevolent foreigner and objects. And it came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning unto the evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, he said, "What is this thing that thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou thyself alone, and all the people stand by thee from morning unto even?" And Moses said unto his father-in-law, "Because the people come unto me to inquire of God. When they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another, and I do make them know the statutes of God and his laws." And Moses' father-in-law said unto him, "The thing that thou doest is not good. Thou wilt surely wear away, both thou and this people that is with thee, for this thing is too heavy for thee. Thou art not able to perform it thyself alone." Exodus 18, 13 to 19. Three sets of dangers lurk within this situation, each realized at a different level of the psychological and social hierarchy. First is the danger posed to the Israelites, both culturally and individually, in the decision to abandon responsibility for ordering their own personal affairs. They hope to shed that hypothetical burden, which is in actuality opportunity itself, but in so doing, doom themselves to a contemptible and counterproductive dependency and forego the benefits of true maturity. They flirt with refusing their destiny, preferring to pass that obligation up the social hierarchy and remain immature, childish, narrowly self-centered, resentful, derisive, incoherent, lost, and divided instead. The second danger is that of the reestablishment of tyranny. The elevation of their prophet to the status of judge is one step away from his crowning as king, the replacement of the Pharaoh, and the exposure of the Israelites to all the dangers from which they so recently escaped. A king can all too easily become an absolute monarch, and an absolute monarch, the head of a degenerating, dynastic, authoritarian regime. It is in this manner that the irresponsible and slavish call forth the power-hungry tyrants. Third is the allied psychological threat to Moses, the temptation of egotism and pride. Elevated above his fellow citizens by their very unwillingness to take responsibility, Moses could all too easily think proudly and highly of himself and be tempted to wield his authority in the form of compulsion and power. This is, in fact, his biggest temptation, as is dramatized time and time again. Moses has the proclivity of the leader to employ force in excess of its necessity when invitation and persuasion would suffice. This occurs when he slays the Egyptian who beats a Hebrew slave, Exodus 2, 11 to 12, when he enables the death of the 3,000 after the excesses of the golden calf, Exodus 32, 27 to 28, and following Korah's rebellion, when the earth opens up and swallows the usurpers, Numbers 16. This tendency is so marked that it becomes evident even when God indicates precisely the contrary, as indicated in Numbers 20, 1 to 13, the incident at the waters of Meribah, where Moses uses the force of his authority to compel the rocks to bring forth water, when he has been called on to employ his words of magic. The invitation to become judge of the Israelites therefore poses the risk of a dangerous inflation of ego or narrow self to Moses, the threat to the integrity of his soul attendant on his taking to himself as his own accomplishment or talent the authority that has been delegated to him as a prophet of God. This is the terrible path of the religious hypocrites, those who use God's name in vain, Exodus 20, 7, and who pray in public, Matthew 6, 5 to 6, for the social benefit of being seen to do so, the mode of being of the Pharisees, who much later conspire in such a deadly fashion against Christ himself. There is little doubt that this offer of elevation to tyrant would be tempting, in the main, to the fractious and irresponsible rabble who Moses is attempting to guide to the Promised Land. The Israelites, after all, repeatedly stressed their nostalgia for the good old days of the iron rod of the Pharaoh while bemoaning the fact of their terrible freedom. Exodus 16, 2-3, Numbers 11, 4-6. They would make Moses a new tyrant in a heartbeat if that would only alleviate them of the burden of their independent destiny. It is also the rare man indeed who can and will refuse the freely offered plaudits of the masses. Who am I to object when everyone clamors to make me the savior? Even when that offer is made as a bribe by those who wish to reject their own personal sovereignty and responsibility. Jethro objects in no uncertain terms, and in a manner that echoes down the centuries. He tells Moses to hand back the responsibility, to teach his people how to solve their own problems, mediate their own disputes, and govern themselves. Hearken now unto my voice, I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with thee. Be thou for the people to Godward, that thou mayest bring the causes unto God. And thou shalt teach them ordinances and laws, and shalt show them the way wherein they must walk, and the work that they must do. Exodus 18, 19-20. This is salutary advice on the psychological front for the Israelites themselves, as well as something that alleviates the strain on Moses and reduces the temptation of power that is being dangled in front of him. Jethro calls on his son-in-law instead to instruct his people so that they can become bearers of their own destiny and authors of their own fate. His words are highly practical and immediately implementable. Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands and rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And let them judge the people at all seasons. And it shall be that every great matter they shall bring unto thee, but every small matter they shall judge. So shall it be easier for thyself, and they shall bear the burden with thee. If thou shalt do this thing, and God command thee so, then thou shalt be able to endure, and all this people shall also go to their place in peace. Exodus 18, 21-23. This idea of a necessary hierarchy of ordering and responsibility both inspired and is evident in the most highly functional of the communal institutions of the present day. We have in the West, for example, a subsidiary structure of court justice, with the lower courts rendering judgment on matters of rather local and specific importance, and higher courts at the ready when more fundamental disputes make their appearance, or when the decision of a lower authority is regarded by the protagonists, complainants, victims, or perpetrators as insufficiently just. Moses' subsequent actions constitute the prototype for such arrangements. So Moses hearkened to the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And they judged the people at all seasons. The hard causes they brought unto Moses, but every small matter they judged themselves. Exodus 18, 24 to 26. Task accomplished, Jethro returns home. And Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went his way into his own land. Exodus 18, 27. The importance of these two micro-narratives can hardly be overstated. The first concentrates on matters more psychological and is predicated on the twin presumptions that a people capable of self-governance must be sufficiently educated to manage the task, and that it is the duty of the just and sovereign leader to ensure the provision of such education. The second focuses on the social and describes the erection of a hierarchy of distributed responsibility. This new organization is the eternal alternative both to the anarchic wasteland inhabited by slaves in the desert and the heavy-handed, arbitrary, and whim-governed tyranny of fear, force, compulsion, and power. An authentically responsible people require and will brook no autocrat. A truly responsible people will take it on themselves to become their own leaders and protect themselves in that manner from slavish subservience and the despair and hopeless nihilism of the desert chaos. An educated, responsible citizenry dispenses with slavish habits, adopts the mindset of true maturity, looks to the best of the past to guide the future, and forges its own fate. It is a paradoxical truth as well that the voluntary shouldering of precisely the responsibility of self-governance lends to life the meaning that keeps hope alive and despair at bay, even during times of trouble when simple happiness is far out of reach. This shouldering is, yet again, the transforming adventure of Abraham, of Jacob, of the Israelites themselves, of the eventual followers of Christ. There is nothing morally relative about any of this. The adoption of the responsibility for self and communal governance is identical to adulthood, identical even to the neurophysiological integration or maturity that at the highest level comprises the individuality that is far-seeing, sacrificial, autonomous, hospitable, productive, generous, and properly communal. The two innovations suggested by Jethro and carried out by Moses are mutually reinforcing as well as alternative to tyranny and slavery. Educated and responsible people make much more able judges, while the establishment of a hierarchy of judgment enables those willing to educate themselves ever more deeply and take on more responsibility as they climb upward, incrementally, toward the pinnacle of Moses, toward God himself, above that. This is a hierarchy of competence and ability, rather than one of power and force. That competence, in the case of judgment, adjudicated by the peers of the would-be judges, who choose from their lower ranks those who should rise, as well as by the beneficiaries of the judges' decisions. The decisions of a competent authority will be accepted voluntarily, even with relief, by those directly affected, who will in turn not so much submit to the authors of such decision, but actively work to support and honor them. It is this competent authority that makes tyranny unnecessary. It is this competent authority whose defining characteristics and principles are criticized derisively and forcefully during times of cultural uncertainty, the death of God, by precisely those who would rule tyrannically if they could but seize the occasion. It is also this competent authority that eliminates slavery itself by requiring the development of the attitudes and habits of the self-governing at every level of the inevitable social hierarchy. The principle of subsidiarity elaborated in this story, that of decentralized and distributed hierarchical responsibility as the alternative to the pathological order of tyranny or chaos of the desert, states that as much freedom and responsibility as possible should be devolved down the chain of command from highest to lowest, so that the former does not presume or take too much, and the latter abdicate the responsibility that generates sustaining meaning and sacrificial maturity. The higher levels of a given hierarchy should be making decisions or even providing guidance only when it is impossible for individuals and the more local groups they belong to, couples, families, business enterprises, towns and cities, even more localized states, to do that in their more local, particularized, and generally more specifically informed environs. When individuals genuinely consult their own conscience and formulate their own goals, they are bringing what might otherwise be a fractious and disjointed intrapsychic multiplicity into a unity. In so doing, they open themselves up to receive a revelation of motivation. They also become determined in what they are willing to prioritize or celebrate or worship, and what they are willing to give up in that pursuit. This united determination is the very basis of a desirable emotional stability, freedom from pain, guilt, grief, and anxiety, and a consequent and an accompanying resilience. Truly motivated individuals, allowed the opportunity to organize their own destinies, or better yet, encouraged to do so, can then negotiate in good faith with those they deal with most directly, their marital partners, children, business associates, and neighbors, to produce the increasingly higher order covenants or contractual arrangements that most effectively engender a productive, generous, secure, and meaningful society. Individuals who have taken responsibility for their own lives can then bargain effectively and honestly to produce agreements that unify them in vision and purpose. This renders those who have done so both predictable and comprehensible to one another, as well as establishing the functional and positive relationships that are defined by a mutual aim. People who truly share a vision, motivated to shoulder the responsibility necessary for its realization, can then cooperate and compete peacefully within the zone of proximal development established by that vision in a manner that can facilitate the mutual gain made possible by voluntary division of labor, better conceptualized as the exchange of specialized skill, and equally voluntary trade. This means that there will be as little as possible left over to do for those playing at higher order and more abstract levels of governance. Referees are hardly necessary in a game where no one is motivated to cheat. It is for such reasons that those who abide by the principle of subsidiarity in political matters insist that governments should refrain from usurping psychological or social functions that could be managed by individuals, couples, families, businesses, or other local institutions. Another reason is that the information necessary to act effectively becomes attenuated as the distance between problem and problem solver increases. First-hand reports are more reliable than second, and second more reliable than third. As information propagates up a hierarchy of responsibility, the amount of noise to signal almost inevitably increases, and the ability of the upper levels to ensure the desired form of attention or action at the lower decreases. The executives of Tower of Babel corporations lose sight of what the engineers who build their products and the salesmen and marketing personnel know about their customers. If there are too many intervening levels of communication, each of which introduce their own bias into the information propagation process, then the head can completely lose track of what the hands and feet are actually doing. This is one of the fundamental problems of gigantism. Power, no, authority, should therefore be devolved to the lowest and most local possible players in a complex game. Paradoxically, this devolution and distribution of responsibility is precisely what enables those who are truly capable of generating a unifying collective vision, abstracting and strategizing over the long term, to do so. If the leaders of a given enterprise assign requisite and challenging responsibility to those who serve them, they are in turn then freed up to operate at the highest levels of abstraction and development they can personally manage. This is a good deal for everyone involved when done properly, when done in a state of play. The more explicitly political formulations of subsidiarity, drawing on what is still implicit or acted out or dramatically portrayed in the Exodus narrative, were developed by the Catholic theologian Thomas Aquinas, who insisted that the proper function of any superior power was to aid the inferior, not to supplant it. The development of the idea of subsidiarity as a tenet of Catholic social thought was inspired by the work of Wilhelm Emanuel von Kettler, the Bishop of Mainz, in the mid to late 19th century. The notion was further elaborated upon by other thinkers in the Catholic tradition, such as Luigi Taparelli da Zeglio, who coined the term subsidiarity in the 19th century. The Catholic Church formally adopted the subsidiarity principle under the rule of Pope Leo XIII in the encyclical Rerum Novarum, 1891, widely disseminating and further developing it with Pope Pius XI's encyclical Quadragesimo Anno, thus formulated. Just as it is gravely wrong to take from individuals what they can accomplish by their own initiative and industry and give it to the community, so also it is an injustice and at the same time a grave evil and disturbance of right order to assign to a greater and higher association what lesser and subordinate organizations can do. The principle of subsidiarity serves as one of the three cornerstones of Catholic social teaching, in concert with an emphasis on human dignity and solidarity. Later, more secular and purely political thinkers, such as the German economist Wilhelm Röpke, argued that the same principle could and should be used to conceptualize and shape governmental and economic structures. The principle was also advocated for strongly by the Austrian-British economist Friedrich Hayek. The founders of the American state likewise viewed authority as residing most properly first in the individual, then the family, town, county, state, and then, and only then, federal government. This ethos is reflected in the 10th Amendment to the American Constitution, which states explicitly, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. The idea of subsidiary responsibility and organization was also incorporated into the European Union's founding treaties, although a skeptic might argue that the centralizing tendency in that organization has now become so strong that breach occurs with more frequency than honor. Such concepts have exerted and continue to exert a powerful influence on political thinkers, primarily in the conservative camp. It is immediately after the establishment of this structure of subsidiarity that the Israelites travel to the base of Mount Sinai, the eternal place where earth reaches up to heaven and the heavenly makes contact with the earthly and material. God instructs Moses to tell the children of Israel the following: "Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Now, therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a particular treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and an holy nation." Exodus 19, 4 to 6. The Israelites have now followed the proper leader, manifested the appropriate faith in the highest of principles, and organized themselves into a responsible hierarchy. They are thus prepared for something deeper, the revelation of the explicit principles of sustainable order themselves. It is appropriate that Moses is the one to receive the revelation. He has faithfully followed the path of the burning bush, attended to what resists tyranny and sustains in the desert wastelands, and meditated deeply on the nature of justice and its interplay with mercy. The great prophet of God has therefore readied himself to acquire knowledge of the law itself. 7.7. The commandments as explicit revelation of custom. God tells Moses to have his people wash their clothes and sanctify themselves in preparation for an appearance of the divine at the uppermost reaches of the holy mountain. And Moses brought forth the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the nether part of the mount. And Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. And when the voice of the trumpet sounded long and waxed louder and louder, Moses spake, and God answered him by a voice. And the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai, on the top of the mount, and the Lord called Moses up to the top of the mount. And Moses went up. And the Lord said unto Moses, "Go down, charge the people, lest they break through unto the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish." Exodus 19, 17 to 21. Why would a full encounter with God be fatal? Biblically speaking, this might be understood by reference, for example, to the cherubim with flaming swords, which, as we have seen and understood, turn every which way, Genesis 3, 24, so they can cut and burn away everything that is not acceptable in the kingdom of heaven. Nothing imperfect can exist at the highest reaches of the straight and narrow path. This is a dictum that is very challenging to sinful and wayward people. If the sad creatures desiring to approach what is highest have practiced to deceive and consequently embodied much of what is not right and good, there might not be much left of them once the swords have done their work. Are the fires of hell proportionate in their intensity to the distance that has been voluntarily established between the sinner and God? Is the terrible swift sword of the divine something experienced as the flames of perdition themselves by those who have consigned themselves to gnashing their teeth in the outer darkness? Something of this sort seems to be implied by both Dante and Milton, from whom we have derived much of our modern conception of hell, a place about which virtually nothing is said in the biblical texts. How might this damage attendant on contact with what is corrective be understood concretely, materially, psychologically, and biologically? We have already established that there is little, if any, difference between what is deep, between that on which much depends, and what is sacred or holy. In many ways, this is a matter of mere definition. There is a category that applies to the most fundamental presuppositions of the hierarchy that prioritizes our attention and sequences and arranges our actions. There is proportionate emotion associated with shift and movement and change in those depths, ranging from unbearable exhilaration to the worst of terror. Some things make very little difference to us one way or another, while others strike us deeply. If we are hit hard enough in the heart, if what is profoundly important and fundamental makes itself manifest to us, it is unclear that we can withstand the upset. The most serious forms of stress can produce permanent psychophysiological damage, even death. In the short term, the stress response induced by exposure to what is anomalous, corrective, unexpected, and undesired is salutary and helpful, preparing us to muster our resources in the event of an emergency. By contrast, chronic activation of the stress response systems, that is, their constant operation in the medium to long term, brings with it a host of detrimental effects consequent to what has become known as allostatic load. The primary hormonal mediators of the stress response, glucocorticoids and catecholamines, have both protective and damaging effects on the body. In the short run, they are essential for adaptation, maintenance of homeostasis, and survival, allostasis. Yet over longer time intervals, they exact a cost, allostatic load, that can accelerate disease processes. The concepts of allostasis and allostatic load center around the brain as interpreter and responder to environmental challenges and as a target of those challenges. In anxiety disorders, depressive illness, hostile and aggressive states, substance abuse, and post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, allostatic load takes the form of chemical imbalances as well as perturbations in the diurnal rhythm, and in some cases, atrophy of brain structures. In addition, growing evidence indicates that depressive illness and hostility are both associated with cardiovascular disease, CVD, and other systemic disorders. Those who have been exposed to violation of their assumptions sufficient to produce severe suffering in the aftermath, those who experience post-traumatic stress disorder, suffer post-event growth of the amygdala, a brain area specialized in the production of negative emotion, as well as shrinkage of the hippocampus, a brain area that inhibits negative emotion, by placing otherwise incomprehensible occurrences into a comprehensible and familiar context. Other changes also occur when things move too rapidly in the depths. For example, the thalamus, a structure key to the intensity of consciousness, becomes increasingly sensitive to sensory stimuli, a transformation that increases the general apprehension associated with virtually every experience. Once bitten, twice shy, and that applies particularly if the wound went deep. Generally speaking, with treatment or natural recovery, often through voluntary exposure, such damage can be rectified. The hippocampus can, for example, regrow and its inhibition be restored. When what is experienced in consequence of voluntary approach is predictable and orderly, when what is experienced can be perceived, conceptualized, and contextualized as familiar, harmless, or useful, at least when approached with requisite ability or skill, then anxiety becomes unnecessary and is constrained. The rites of purification and sanctification that the Israelites undergo are practices to protect themselves against a too intense encounter with the divine. We can and do undertake actions and erect structures of interpretation to filter the world. This idea could be broadened to cover knowledge itself, the representations we develop as a consequence of repeated experience with a given phenomenon, contextualize that phenomenon, and either strip it completely of its significance or narrow it to the particulars of function specific to the skill we have developed while previously interacting, mastering, or, for that matter, ritualizing the phenomenon. With this, memory inhibits the intensity of the miraculous. C.G. Jung said as much when he intimated that organized religion provides a defense against religious experience, pointing out as well that a counterproductive narrowing can easily accompany that defensive process, strategy, or tradition. What is ordinarily called religion is a substitute to such an amazing degree that I ask myself seriously whether this kind of religion, which I prefer to call a creed, may not, after all, have an important function in human society. The substitute has the obvious purpose of replacing immediate experience by a choice of suitable symbols tricked out with an organized dogma and ritual. The Catholic Church maintains them by her indisputable authority. The Protestant Church, if this term is still applicable, by insistence on belief in the evangelical message. So long as these two principles work, people are effectively protected against immediate religious experience. Even if something of the sort should happen to them, they can refer to the church, for she would know whether the experience came from God or from the devil, and whether it is to be accepted or rejected. And so we replace the eternal burning bush with merely generic perception, draining it of what might otherwise be overwhelming divine significance. But there's a tree of many one, a single field which I have looked upon. Both of them speak of something that is gone. The pansy at my feet doth the same tale repeat. Whither is fled the visionary gleam? Where is it now, the glory and the dream? It is not obvious at all that our mortal frames can withstand a direct encounter with the absolute, and the degree to which such an encounter could harm us may also be affected by the volume of spiritual deadwood we have accumulated. The purifying fire of God's burning sword could easily look like hell to those most fundamentally characterized by the accretion of sin. At the peak of the mountain, that is, at the top of the hierarchy, at the pinnacle of the system of values, Moses receives the explicit revelation of the rules that guide society from God himself. Psychologically speaking, he experiences a profound, even revolutionary, moment of insight, which might be regarded as an instance of translation of one form of knowing to another. Imagine for a moment a wolf pack or troop of chimpanzees Their constant competitive and cooperative interactions eventually settle into a predictable, even multi-generationally stable pattern. That pattern is the hierarchical structure of the society in question. The relatively permanent status of each individual compared and contrasted with every other. Each member of the pack or troop knows his or her status. It is as if the small society is organized according to a set of social rules. But it is not, because rules are statable. The hierarchical arrangement is instead a pattern that characterizes and stabilizes the interactions of the group members. Suppose next that the pack or troop members now develop the ability not only to govern their attention and actions in keeping with that pattern, but to represent that same pattern in image, to imagine the pattern of habit and custom. This is development of the ability to translate purely procedural knowledge, embodied skill, into pictorial abstraction, into something dreamlike that can be present in the absence of the actors in question, even manipulated and experimented with, when the ability develops further. This now means that the world can be transformed in imagination without direct practical consequence. This constitutes a great leap forward in the capacity to abstract, a major milestone in the development, a veritably qualitative transformation of thought. Once the image of the action has been established, or more generally, an image of the pattern of the action, a further possibility opens up for creatures that have established the ability to communicate and apprehend semantically or linguistically. The subsequent or consequent translation of the image into the word. It is in this manner that the habits that come to govern the interactions of a society can first be portrayed dramatically. And then, from that dramatic portrayal, represented explicitly in language. This is the emergence of the law, but a law that is simultaneously mirrored in the underlying dream or image and in the behavioral practices that make up group tradition, expectation, norm, ideal, and taboo. This translation of form, this flash of intuition, strikes Moses with the force of a divine revelation. And well, it should. The explicit understanding of the structure of psychological integration and social unity alike is a profoundly revolutionary development, a genuine and qualitatively transformative milestone in the development of higher conscious culture, something on the order of a fundamental biological mutation. The coding of behavioral patterns in image gives the image the depth of the behavioral pattern, which is in turn something that emerged in an interactive, iterative, and ultimately evolutionary manner. The behavioral pattern, as such, is both embodied and distributed, rather than being explicitly understood or something characteristic of a particular individual. It is the consequence of all the interactions of all the individuals in question, past and present, who established the traditions, the hierarchical structure of interactions, in large part, of the group. The nuances of that structure are clearly more complex than can be acted out completely, let alone fully understood, by any given member of the group. This means that the pattern of interactions characterizing the group contains more information than any of the individual members realize, regardless of how completely they have adapted to that pattern behaviorally or mapped it imaginatively or linguistically. This pool of implicit information comes to serve as the storehouse of behavior and imagination, enabling further revelation. How? The behavioral pattern of the group is a model of the environment in which the group emerged, including the environment constituted by the group, as indicated previously. Since that behavioral pattern supersedes in its complexity and subtlety the understanding of any individual within the group, society is therefore complex in its totality beyond comprehension, leaving us all to be anthropologists, even within our own tribe. The structures and processes of imagination that depict that pattern in drama and dream re-represent that information, but in a manner more complete than any explicit emergent semantic coding can manage. The dream is thus the birthplace of what comes to be coded verbally, as well as the container within which it rests and the intermediary between the explicit and behavior itself, the behavior that encompasses both the pattern of attention and the pattern of action. This is why a dream can present to a dreamer information that the dreamer himself does not yet know. The dream encodes the depth of the culture in a manner transcending that which is merely statable. This is why Shakespeare and Dostoevsky could see beyond even the ken of a thinker with the genius of Nietzsche, to take particular examples from the parallel worlds of the writers of fiction and the philosophers. This is why the worlds of the great literary masters are both inexhaustible and unerring in a manner that even the most stellar and brilliant operators in the more purely verbal and explicit domain cannot manage. This is why literary criticism, as well as its twin, the analysis of dreams, are not only both possible and necessary, but of a rather stunning, crucial importance. This is how philosophy is necessarily embedded in the narrative, and the narrative in ritual and cultural tradition. This is how the rules, once made explicit, retain their connection with the underlying imagination, practices, and even environment or cosmos of people now aware in a communicable manner of the rules that govern their individual and collective existence. It is no wonder that all this is represented as an encounter with God on Mount Sinai by the imaginative authors of the great book of Exodus. The mountain itself is arranged such that God is at its pinnacle. Moses, prophet of God, is next. The priests are third in line, and let the priests also, which come near to the Lord, sanctify themselves, lest the Lord break forth upon them. Exodus 19:22. And the common people at the base. This is another representation of Jacob's ladder, as well as an analog of the structure of subsidiarity. And all the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. And they said unto Moses, speak thou with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die. And Moses said unto the people, fear not, for God is come to prove you, and that his fear may be before your faces, that ye sin not. And the people stood afar off, and Moses drew near unto the thick darkness where God was. Exodus 20:18-21. Why all the smoke and fire? Because it is no small matter for a people to become explicitly conscious, no matter how shallowly, of the divine order that governs them. This is, after all, nothing less than the beginning of the law. Should something that revolutionary, that epoch-making, not be signified by something of dramatic portent? The rules are both much more detailed in their connotations and deeper in their essence than casual familiarity with the Ten Commandments themselves might indicate. They exist to some degree as the so-called self-evident axioms of assumption that all more differentiated moral claims rely on for their apparent validity, with the 10 familiar to most making up the core. That sense of self-evidence is in itself a reflection of the concordance of the commandments with long-established behavioral practice and cultural custom, and the structures of imagination that secondarily come to represent and contain that practice and custom. It is the fact of such concordance that belies any claim of moral equivalence or relativism. There is a very limited number of complex, sustainable, productive, generous, voluntary social games. A clear pattern of their portrayal in the dramas of imagination, and a clearly identifiable and stable set of rules or principles that can be derived from that underlying pattern and representation. The Ten Commandments reflect the patterns of attention and action on which many other patterns rest, or are, in other words, the rules on which many other rules depend. They are deep or fundamental because of that, by definition. Under those 10, according to later revelation, lurks something even deeper, the so-called Great Commandment, which has two separate elements that are in turn united in their essence. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. Matthew 22:37. And thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Matthew 22:39. Why united? Because there is no difference, and this, once again, is the monotheistic insistence, between the Spirit of God and the Spirit that calls to each of us to treat all the members of our community as if they were extensions of the ultimate self. The Great Commandment is a meta-rule, describing as it does the founding principle or pinnacle aspiration of the 10 separate explicit rules. The Great Commandment also characterizes the nature of the Spirit and relationship that gives rise to those rules, or that emerges in consequence of their devout following. Christ makes, in conclusion, with regard to his uniting, an unexpected and brilliant utterance. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Matthew 22:40. What does this all mean? Set your sights first on the highest possible goal. Then understand that there is no real difference between regard for the self, at least as conceptualized in the most sophisticated manner, and the treatment of others, not least because of the inevitable reciprocal consequences of iterated social interactions. Realize as well that there is no difference between that regard and treatment and belief in, or even embodiment or incarnation of, the Spirit of God. In consequence of that underlying unity, the two elements of the Great Commandment emerge. In consequence of those two, the 10 commandments, which are the panoply of differentiated rules that make up the explicit semantic representation of the traditional stabilizing, regulating, and enabling practices of the culture. It is a corollary of this hierarchical structure that the more peripheral laws are liable to be more culture-specific and the deeper principles more universal. This realization allows for a certain relativism in some moral matters. Some rules are going to be very specific to the vagaries of particular time and place, but a necessary absolutism in others. Some rules are so fundamental that no human game can be played in their absence. This can be seen in the relationship between the first stated canonical 10 commandments and the many more specific and situation-dependent rules that follow. 1. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Exodus 20:3. 2. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Exodus 20:4. 3. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Exodus 20:7. 4. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Exodus 20:8. 5. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Exodus 20:12. 6. Thou shalt not kill. Exodus 20:13. 7. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Exodus 20:14. 8. Thou shalt not steal. Exodus 20:15. 9. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Exodus 20:16. 10. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. Exodus 20:17. Contrast those with the rules listed in the following chapters, mainly dealing with the specific dispensation of property, elements of social responsibility, and the details of the administration of justice tempered by mercy. Exodus 21-23. If a man opens or digs a pit and fails to cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restitution. He must pay its owner, and the dead animal will be his. Exodus 21:33-34. If a fire breaks out and spreads to thorn bushes so that it consumes stacked or standing grain or the whole field, the one who started the fire must make full restitution. Exodus 22:6. You must not exploit or oppress a foreign resident, for you yourselves were foreigners in the land of Egypt. Exodus 22:21. You must not mistreat any widow or orphan. Exodus 22:22. If you take your neighbor's cloak as collateral, return it to him by sunset, because his cloak is the only covering he has for his body. Exodus 22:26. You shall not follow the crowd in wrongdoing. When you testify in a lawsuit, do not pervert justice by siding with the crowd. Exodus 23:2. And do not show favoritism to a poor man in his lawsuit. Exodus 23:3. The precise placement of each rule in the hierarchy of desirable practice is subject to constant debate, which is intrinsic to the constant theological, narrative, and philosophical enterprise of mankind, which is part of the building of the eternal pyramid stretching to heaven and its tempering by heat and pressure, which is part of the process of naming and subduing the world that God gave Adam as endless mission. The existence of this justly debatable variability does not imply that nothing is central, that everything is equally and nihilistically, anarchically, or hedonistically peripheral. The golden rule, and as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise, Luke 6:31, is a variant of the second part of the great commandment, indicated more clearly in Matthew 7:12. Therefore, all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them. For this is the law and the prophets. That rule is an example of the explicit statement of an evolved indirect reciprocity. I help you, and somebody else helps me. The same pattern has been modeled or observed emerging, by game theorists, formally modeling iterative interactions, and has been summarized by such researchers as follows. Firstly, individuals tend to adopt cooperative strategies in the long-term process of building interpersonal networks. Secondly, stronger trust foundations between individuals lead to greater cohesiveness under cooperation strategies. Finally, to maintain interpersonal networks under the betrayal strategy, it is essential to continuously add new nodes to the network. The latter comment indicates what is necessary for the betrayers, the psychopaths, the predatory parasites, to continue successfully implementing their non-reciprocal or narrowly self-serving strategy. A constant stream of new and naive, willfully blind, or otherwise unknowing victims. This tactic is, by the way, identical to the necessary, inevitable, and unconscious wandering of Cain. Why? Because all those who depend on a pattern of second-rate sacrifice, embittered by their rejection, aiming at revenge, find themselves compelled to move from place to place, seeking out new victims. Those they betray once, twice, or even thrice remember and subsequently refuse to continue in their role as pawns, patsies, lackeys, or worse. The cross-cultural prevalence of a conception or principle of moral conduct similar to that of the Golden Rule has been noted by many authors, and is something held as central by the practitioners and formulators of many of the world's religions. This is as much evolved adaptation as divine injunction. God then reiterates to the Israelites his promise of eventual universal victory if they abide by the delivered dictates. So you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take away sickness from among you. No woman in your land will miscarry or be barren. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion every nation you encounter. I will make all your enemies turn and run. I will send the hornet before you to drive the Hivites and Canaanites and Hittites out of your way. Exodus 23:25-28. Those who follow the angel of the Lord will triumph. This is a reiteration of the continual insistence in the Old Testament and the New that those who align themselves with the implicit moral order will triumph. Moses convenes with God on the peak of Mount Sinai for 40 days and nights in what appears as a consuming fire in the eyes of the Israelites, Exodus 24:17, and receives, in consequence, the stone tablets with the Ten Commandments inscribed upon them. Inscribed stone signifies, as in the case of a grave marker, permanence, memory, reverence, and attention, as it takes time and care to carve stone. After his receipt of the rules, the prophet is given detailed instructions for the construction of the Ark of the Covenant, designed to contain the stone tablets, as well as the mobile tabernacle or church that will surround and house that ark. Moses is given the law and the means of transmitting it across time. The church or temple that came over the ensuing millennia to occupy central or prime position in the increasingly permanent settlements founded everywhere. The law is therefore established in the explicit form of the commandments and their accompanying rules, at the same time as the ineffably divine at the center of the community. That allows for both a place for and reminder of the proper upward sacrifice on which both psychological stability and social being are necessarily predicated. God is therefore placed in the central position of the community, accompanied by the central rules he established, hemmed in by the successive veils of the tabernacle, another indication of hierarchy and subsidiarity, surrounded in turn by the community. The pattern is established not only for all social arrangement, but also for the psyche that is unified, and for both perception and conception, even in their individual or particular elements. Everything consciously apprehensible is a divine or heavenly idea, surrounded by a periphery of increasing distance and multiplicity. This is as true for the objects of our perception as it is for our ideas about those objects. The community within which the ideal is thereby situated is subsequently enjoined to offer something of value, gold, silver, brass, dye and skins, oil and incense, and precious stones, so that this holy sanctuary can all be made possible. This is one of the aforementioned sacrificial acts, allowing for the very existence of the productive social world. Obviously, something must be given up by each individual so that the benefits of community can be obtained. A world of all against all, which is the alternative, is a world of endless war and privation, and not the paradise of anarchic hedonism imagined by the Canaanites, the occupants of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the worshippers of the golden calf. This practice of offering to establish a place of divine beauty is simultaneously both the founding and explicit sanctification of the practice of patronage for the arts, which are the manifestation in imagination and play of the spirit that exists at the center and unites. Beauty and deep story are avenues to the divine, alternative and accompanying forms of worship, however implicit that worship might yet be. The Ark's cover, the mercy seat, was held to be the place or symbol of atonement. The very word means at-one-ment, the place of reconciliation between fragmented, anxious, and hopeless sinner and God, and, in keeping with that central role, constructed of pure gold, the noblest of metal, unwilling, even as empirical fact, to mate promiscuously with other metals, and able to keep its purity forever. This throne was bracketed by two cherubim, reminiscent of the angels guarding the gates of paradise. Is this combination of the idea of atonement and the harshest of discrimination and judgment a reflection of the idea of the gathering of the wheat and the shedding of the chaff? Matthew 3:12. Is the repentance of sins equivalent to the shedding of deadwood and the cutting away of what would be inappropriate in heaven itself? Is this all something attained as a consequence of the highest conceivable or ultimate form of sacrifice? The mercy seat was located within the tabernacle in the central place, the Holy of Holies, a room that could be entered only once a year on the Day of Atonement, and then only by the high priest. On that day, he would sprinkle upon it the blood of a sacrificial lamb. This is voluntary, celebratory giving up of everything lower to that which is higher and ultimately highest. That is also atonement, the production of the one from the many, because everything comes together under what is highest in precise proportion to the degree of sacrifice. This is first something external, perfect and innocent, the offering of some property or other item of genuine value. But that is insufficient just as the externalization of evil is insufficient. There are indeed predators, literal serpents and beasts of prey. However, there are also snakes in the hearts of your enemies, metaphorically speaking, and they can present an even greater danger. Such realization and representation is the first stage in the transformation of the idea of predatory evil into something deeper, more profound, and psychological. But that is not yet sufficient abstraction. There is also, all too often, evil lurking in the hearts, even of family members and friends. Betrayal is common. The closer the relationship within which it makes itself present, the closer it cuts to the bone. But the worst snake of all is the one that dwells within. We are never betrayed more seriously.